And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to another Ancient Warfare Magazine podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode of the podcast, we'll be looking at Volume 9, Issue 3, The Mighty Rulers of Anatolia, the Hittites and their Successors. For more information on the magazine, go into ancient-warfare.com. Joining me tonight is Joshua Browers, Murray Darm, Matt McCaffrey, Sean Manning and Stephen Weingartner. So for those listeners who've not read the magazine, let's start with who are the Hittites.
Very briefly, you can say that in the first half of the Late Bronze Age, you have four major powers, which are the Hittites, the Egyptians, the Mitanni, and the Babylonians. And about halfway through, the Mitanni Empire sort of disintegrates because of all the troubles that we will undoubtedly get to later. And then it sort of shifts. The power vacuum is filled in with the Assyrian Empire that sort of rises to the fore. Mm. So you have this Late Bronze Age that's dominated by four major powers, largely with various hangers-on around it, including Azawa in the west and Ahiyawa in the west somewhere. Whether they are Achaeans in the sense of Greeks is a matter of debate and how far they stretch and how small. But you have these four major powers. So initially Egypt, Mitanni, Babylon, and then further to the west, the Hittites, and then halfway through, the Mitanni disappear, and that vacuum gets filled up by the Assyrians, and that lasts until about 1200 BC, when there's a big catastrophe that we also talked about briefly in the podcast on issue 9.1 on the fall of Rome, where all these Bronze Age kingdoms basically collapse to a greater or lesser degree, including the Hittites, who disintegrate. And then that sort of paves the way for the early Iron Age with the emergence of Neo-Hittite kingdoms and other peoples known from historic sources like the Carians and the Phrygians and the Lydians, etc., etc., all of which touched upon in the issue. I think this way listeners will have some sort of idea of what we're talking about in the major political players.
These are all very land-based empires, aren't they?
Except for Ahiyawa.
But is anything certain over them being more based around sea, or is that just theoretical?
The recent research and the people I've been talking to and et cetera, are becoming more adamant than ever that Ahiyawa was a fairly centralized Bronze Age Greek confederation dominated by a primer inter pares, which would have been at Mycenae, that they dominated most of the Aegean.
And are you absolutely sure about that?
Of course I'm not sure.
No. Because these are ideas indeed that are floating around. And initially when the Ahiyawa popped up, there were some people that said, could these be Homer's Achaeans? And it's pretty sure now that they are indeed Greek, that they are Mycenaeans also by way of the structure of their names and that sort of stuff. Eteocles is attested in perfectly acceptable Mycenaean Greek rendered in Hittite form, etc., etc. But the problem is how to identify the kingdom of these Ahiyawa, and that might be an island off the coast of Asia Minor. It might be some place on the coast of Asia Minor, the area of Miletus or Ephesus or whatever, or it might indeed be somewhere on the Greek mainland. But the exact nature and size of the Ahiyawa kingdom is still a matter of heated debate, as far as I know. But
I just keep reading in terms of books talking about the period, sort of saying, of course, the islands are so close together. It seems like an assumed thing that, of course, they've got naval trade going on in this kingdom. but it doesn't seem necessarily to be, you know, apart from, okay, there, you know, a couple of illustrations here and there, it doesn't seem to pick up a foregone conclusion necessarily, since all the others seem to be really centrally based in land.
Because also with the Mycenaean Greeks, if you want to propose that Mycenaean Greece is Ahiyawa, you would have to find some sort of evidence that it's a centralized country in and of itself, and the evidence isn't really doesn't really exist for that. It has been argued by some people who have not been taken very seriously that Mycenaean Greece was a unified empire at one point, but that the evidence for that is very, very slight, especially when you consider the autonomy of the different citadels and the road systems and everything else.
Okay, I respectfully disagree with that. If Akiyawa was not a Greek realm, what the hell was it? And where was it located?
Well, like I said, it could very well be just a part of Anatolia or some islands or...
I don't think that's tenable at all anymore. That seems to me to be a very old a conjecture that most people seem to be rejecting lately.
Such as?
Rich Beal at the Oriental Institute, Hittite experts like Theo Vandenhoek, Billie Jean Collins. Collins is very adamant that Akiyawa is a Mycenaean Greek, or let's say Bronze Age Greek realm. I think the evidence that a country that powerful, a nation that powerful, would be confined to the west coast of Anatolia, what with Arzawa there and Milwanda being technically owned by the Hittites, that really leads to problems. I mean, who or where would it have been? And also, in the text, first of all, Pupil Iliuma banishes his wife Henti, the mother of his five sons, to Akiyawa, sending her over the sea. So that would indicate that Akiyawa was either in the islands or on the Greek mainland.
No, I don't think that's in any doubt. It's just a matter of the scope and the scale of the Akiyawa lands.
At one point, the Hittite king talks about the king of Akiyawa appearing in battle against him with a force of something like 100 chariots, which indicates a pretty powerful power projection ability. Maintaining a chariotry army in the field required a great deal of sophistication. I think that's a further sign. Now, I will admit that these translations have been disputed. Nevertheless, we have them there, and we can talk about them in that light.
My next question was going to be about what do we know about their society, hopefully leading to the clay tablets, because surely quite a lot of what we know comes from these clay tablets.
Sean, you wrote an interesting article in the issue on the...
Guard's Rule.
God's Rule, which has perhaps my most favorite introduction of any article.
Yeah, that is a good quote.
Thanks for that one. Thanks.
May he go pee. So if listeners are curious about that, you have to buy the issue, sorry.
As I understand it, at some point in one of the Hittite campaigns down into the upper Tigris, upper Euphrates, they decided the thing to do was to do what all the cool kids are doing, which was to have scribes writing in cuneiform on clay. Imported or captured or hired or whatever scribes and set them up writing. Because this was often written on clay, not always, you know, they were writing on wax tablets and things like that as well. And because at some point Hattusis was burned and abandoned and left the town up with dirt, we have all of these archives and literary and copies of literary texts and things that we don't have for a lot of ancient societies. We do have these fragments of what looks an awful like tactical military literature. In my article, I talk about the instructions for the border guards, which are this one incomplete copy of a text that's has all the rules for the procedures that the royal bodyguard have to follow every day. So first for what they do when they're standing guard at the palace and people are coming and going. What to do when the king wants to go for a ride in his chariot through countryside or to serve as a judge for cases, how to set up the procession of the guards. They don't really have this kind of thing for classical antiquity, as far as I can recall, that gives this very detailed, very everyday picture of what soldiers of the standing army are spending most of their lives doing.
But why would we have this text, really? Why would it be produced? It seems to be either, you know, something that could be used against their organization, and, you know, something prime for, you know, knowing exactly how to, you know, launch an attack on the king as he's out riding, as such, or is it something that's being produced as an observation by someone who's, you know, critically observing it? Or is it really just a training manual? Do they need a training manual? Are there enough people reading at the time and who are going to read it being in a position of a guardsman?
That gets into a really interesting question. How extensive was literacy?
Actually, can I just make it more complicated and say, I think one of the articles, I think, in the magazine for this edition, sort of gave the idea that there are a number of different dialects, you know, going across the Turkish peninsula at this time. So exactly how much of the population would this particular dialect be used by in terms of the reading population?
And in the Kekule text, we have a Mitannian of Indo-Aryan, perhaps, descent, who's writing in Hittite, but the Hittites don't have the words for horse training, so he resorts to using Indic words. And in the text, he says, he tells his Hittite readers, this means, or that means. In other words, he uses the Indic word and then translates it in the text for the Hittites.
What's the language that's been used in Wallusia at the time as well? Because that seems to be related to the Hittite, but also, you know, differences as well. And then, yeah.
Depending on their ethnicity, they spoke probably a mixture of Luwian Hittite, and they might have spoken Linear B Greek, too. Mm. I mean, there's at least one theory. I'm not saying I subscribe to it, but that whole of Western Anatolia was colonized to a certain extent by Linear B Greeks, and that's why we have the tradition in the Iliad of the Trojans and the Greeks being able to speak to each other. That might be fanciful, but it's interesting anyway.
We know that there were Mycenaeans in Western Anatolia, but there were loads of different peoples living there also. And one of the things that is usually underestimated is the level of bilingualism. If you look at the historic period in Anatolia, one of the main characteristics, and all books and conferences have been held on that particular subject, that Greeks living in Asia Minor in the historic period were usually also bilingual, so that they would be able to converse, at least some number of them, both in Greek and in Lydian, for example, which would have been the major language there. I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to say that in the late Bronze Age, a similar situation would have happened, would have occurred, where in a city like Milawanda, where you had probably a small population of Mycenaean Greeks living with local Luwian people or whatever, where they would be able to converse with each other using one language or the other. And I think that's also what sort of the idea behind the situation in the Iliad, because even though the Greek heroes are able to converse with each other, Homer makes the point that when the Trojan army bursts out of the city gates, for example, there's a cacophony of noises from the armor, from the lack of discipline, supposedly, but also all the different languages that they speak.
Yeah, that's a real good point. Yeah.
So it's probably very varied, but people were able to communicate anyway because they learned each other's languages.
Of course, as the language of diplomacy, they could always fall back on Akkadian, which kind of served the same purpose as Latin did in later periods.
Yeah, or Greek in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, of course.
Right, right.
To go back to the reading, it's always been my understanding that because of the complexity of cuneiform, only few people were able to actually read it. What I would imagine they would have done
in the late Bronze Age with something like the Horse Trainer's Manual or the Guardsman Manual is do what they also did in the historic period. Texts were not written mostly to be read silently by somebody, but they were written to be read out loud. So I imagine that if somebody said, I need instructions in the way of horse training, or I need to know what the duties are of a guardsman, a scribe would pick the necessary tablets and start reading, you know, or saying, what do you want to know precisely, and then reading the relevant passage out loud. That's been sort of a bit my understanding, because also royalty usually didn't learn to read, or wasn't necessary for them to read or write, because they had scribes to do all that.
There has been the kind of a pushback on the idea that Akkadian cuneiform was inherently so difficult that only a tiny, highly educated scribal class could read it. Because if you're willing to use the system in a relatively alphabetic way, so mostly the syllable signs, you can get away with about 100 signs with not all that many different meanings. Say, a bit before the Hittites come around, we have things like these Assyrian trading posts or Kadi in eastern Anatolia. The sites are just full of tablets written in very bad handwriting and very small sign inventory and mostly just letters and business records and things like that. There are some people who'd argue now that, say, at least in the places where Akkadian was a native language, that it probably wasn't unusual for, say, people in, say, the wealthier upper half of the population to at least be able to read a simple letter or something like that.
I don't know the level of, you know, how far down the reading goes, but it occurs to me that the people of the Bronze Age were inveterate record keepers. Accounting is the beginning of written language back then. And they kept records. Oh, my God. If you read the Ugarit files, you find divorces and lawsuits and angry letters about a wife treating her husband badly and vice versa. So there must have been a lot of scribes around, if nothing else.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in Egypt, they were a separate class even, I think, if I recall correctly. So there were loads of scribes. I don't think that's an issue.
We keep finding little deposits of written texts. You know, we'll put Vindolanda. You know, they keep turning up. We wonder how much more of these things are going to keep rolling out.
And not only that, they keep translating old texts that have been excavated decades ago, but were never really researched properly. So.
Well, they were saying the last weekend, actually, at a conference at the British Museum about how much of a backlog they've got from the Vindolanda texts at the moment, that they are just pulling them out by the bucket load, but they just have got only a couple working on them. So
we have got the same problem as they had then, is we're not enough people to read them. You generate all this stuff.
Young people shouldn't learn to code. They should learn cuneiform.
I'll switch my Latin class over tomorrow.
I think the other thing that's always interesting is that the single discovery is still enough to turn our knowledge or our supposed knowledge on its head. With the discovery of the Pylos tomb recently, you know, suddenly everything's questions that we thought we knew with a new discovery of a text or a new translation of a text, suddenly what's been accepted and what was the current theory is suddenly turned on its head by a single piece of evidence or a single interpretation, and it just shows how fragile our knowledge is, which is something that, you know, none of us really want to sort of walk around, because we'd have to be on eggshells the entire time. But it's so fascinating, and you know, the like with the Kekule text, where you've got a Mitannian writing for the Hittites, it's like, well, what are you doing there? Are you a traitor? Are you this? Is there other, you know, and there are more complicated explanations. And it's so fascinating. And getting back to, you know, why would you tell everybody what your royal guardsman's duties are? Because if they can read it, then, as you say, you know, it's the perfect assassination plot tool, because you know when they're going to be changing the guard and when they're doing all of that. So it is this. There's something obviously going on that we don't necessarily have access to understanding yet, if we ever do, unfortunately.
doesn't have to be specifically an assassination tool. I remember, for example, with JFK, his tour through Dallas was meticulously outlined in a newspaper, something like a week before he was actually there. So it's, you know, in 3,500 years, we don't learn a lot more, I guess.
But when you write something down as well, and this, you know, there's a rigidity to it as well. You're literally setting it in stone. So it does mean that once you've written down, and then someone says, actually, this is a better way of doing it, what you've written is out of date. Or did stuff not change? They're just kind of, or you might have, if it hasn't been amended, do people, the next people along, just do the same thing as was written down, and then they would learn, and then, and if it doesn't get written down again, the next person goes back to the start point that was written down, because things were literally written in stone.
That's the funny thing about the one copy we have. It's incomplete, and it's clear that the scribe wrote it down partially and realized he left out some things and then wrote some things in the margins. What kind of text he was working from, and was it something that had been stuck in the back corner of the archives and nobody had read it for 100 years?
Does that tell us something about the scribe, though, as well? I mean, going back to an example of the Vigilante tablets, you've got one of those that quotes the Aeneid, and of course gets something absolutely wrong, and that's been taken to mean that it's a student copying down a text and getting something wrong in their student copy. I mean, have we got something like that happening with that text from the Hittite collection, that it is a copy being practiced on, or an apprentice coming through, attempting to do the next version of the manual from the previous one?
It's also the argument with medieval scribes is, did they copy or did they conflate? Is your picture of a scribe someone with four manuscripts and they're writing one, and that they're, rather than copy a single manuscript, they are in fact conflating several? So the modern idea is that conflation is more common than previously thought. So the margin comment is when you read another text and you go back to your copy and you realize, oh, I missed that bit out, or where you put chapters that aren't necessarily concurrent in another manuscript, you put them together. And certainly in the medieval period, where handbooks, yes, they evolve, but they, in another way, they don't. So I just did a piece on Vegetius's Epitoma, which, we start getting copies in the 7th century and don't stop getting copies until the 18th century. And it's always Vegetius, but there's bits and pieces added to show a contemporary relevance.
I have a question for the assembly here. When do you guys think that people, scribes, writers, went from being mere accountants to chroniclers, writing annals, and then to being historians? I mean, you have some tremendously interesting historical documents like the Egyptian accounts of the Battle of Kadesh and the Annals of Mursili, things like that. But when do you actually get into people going into the field saying, I'm going to write history?
Yeah, I think the issue is, of course, that the idea of history and who history's for doesn't exist. It's, royal, the Kadesh Stele is a royal account. So there's royal accounts of events. Are they history? Yes, they're recording events. And like with Kadesh, it's spin doctoring it if you're going to be very generous. That history. I mean, we use it as a historical source. We use all of these documents as historical sources because we think of them historically. And one of the things with handbooks, obviously, is they're not meant to be history. The handbook on how to be a royal guardsman or how to train your chariot horses is not meant to be historically informative. It's meant to be instructional, how to train your horse, not instructional for people in a future generation to realize how Hittites trained horses. So I think in that sense, we're unable to access when does history start, because we are looking at things from the historian's perspective, as opposed to we're all royal scribes looking for that You know, and it's the same with linguistics and philology. If I want to look for an obscure word on horse, you know, stuff, he says, not having the word, I would go and find it, and I would show my erudition by knowing another language. And that's not historical. It's you know, an erudite horse guy.
I've just finished working on the extra content for Ancient History magazine, which is something that Kickstarter backers are going to be receiving, some of them at least. And one of the articles in there by Sean Husman is on Herodotus as not a historian as such, but as an investigative journalist.
Ah, that's interesting.
Because he back when he was writing, history did not exist, and he's considered the father of history. But what he was doing is more to what a journalist does than more similar to what a journalist does than what, as we would describe it, a historian writes. He has sort of human interest stories and some gossip and local folklore and all that stuff, and that isn't too different from what you would see just, you know, folklorists and whatever writing down and what a journalist today would do. He does interviews with people to find out about Marathon. He goes to Egypt and writes a sort of an ethnographic, very lengthy chapter on those people. History is a bit difficult as a concept to put back in ancient time.
In that sense.
Especially in the early period.
In that sense, wouldn't it be Thucydides, really, who sort of takes on the narrative as such properly?
Well, he makes a specific point of writing not for the immediate present, but for the for forever, basically. And he's probably writing that to go against Herodotus, maybe, because Herodotus' text was being read out about the time that Thucydides started writing his Peloponnesian War overview. So, yeah, he may have been the first to really say, you know, I'm just going to try to figure out the real story behind this, even though he was not an impartial writer, obviously.
I've read that people are beginning to take Herodotus more seriously than they used to. Is that true? Are they beginning to think that he's actually more accurate than used to be the case?
It sort of goes up and down. These days, people are less dismissive of Herodotus than they have been for a while. But it sort of, yeah, it sort of comes and goes throughout scholarship. There was a period in which it was very common to sort of dismiss everything that Herodotus said, and then archaeologists started discovering stuff that sort of confirmed some of the things that he was writing about. There's still a lot of stuff in the history that is clearly fabricated. Also, in some cases, he picks different versions of stories. He picks something that he personally likes. For example, Ephialtes at Thermopylae is a good example. He has this whole story about Ephialtes, whose name later becomes a byword for nightmare. Which is probably completely rubbish, probably completely fabricated, because the Persians with their army would not have needed some sort of Greek traitor to lead them through a mountain pass. The Persians would have been able to find it perfectly by themselves, but it serves Herodotus' purpose of showing the Persians is basically inept without Greek help. That's why they have Greek advisors whose advice they continuously ignore. So you have a Greek coming to the Persian king saying, oh, we should do this and that. And then the Persian king says, no, I will not listen to you because I'm an obstinate Persian and I will do my own thing. And then, of course, he fails and, you know, it turns out that if he followed the Greek advice, everything would have been fine. So there are those kinds of elements in Herodotus' writing that are clearly that serve his particular purpose. But there is stuff in there that is accurate, as far as I know. The problem is that for a lot of stuff that Herodotus describes, the only source we really have is Herodotus. So there is a bit of a problem. It's better if you have, for example, in later periods where you have Polybius and Livy and God knows who, Diodorus Siculus, etc., giving different versions of a particular story where you can compare and contrast and try to figure out
which source they used and which is more reliable, etc., etc. And you don't really have that for Herodotus for a large to a large extent. So that's a bit of a problem. But you can sort of recognize the logo, and of course that's something that in scholarship on Herodotus is a very old tradition, trying to sort of filter out the fact from the fiction in his
account. I mean, the other thing with the Ephialtes is his end is an unfulfilled promise, which there aren't that many of in Herodotus. I think the Assyrian history that he promises is also something that he never follows through on, more's the pity. But also, I think the interesting thing about Herodotus is, from an investigative reporter, is, you know, that he's often been accused of being naive, at the very least, if not the father of lies, which is the opposite view, you know, father of history or father of lies. But that whole idea that, you know, he gets told these things when he goes and interviews people, and he gullibly writes it down as if it's fact, you know, the flying snakes and things like that. But there are ways to rationalize out what he says. The hippopotamus is very interesting, because what he describes is not a hippopotamus, but what he describes of what you could see of a hippopotamus is exactly accurate. And then all of the stuff under the water is completely wrong, but then he's been told by the Egyptians, presumably, that it's a water horse. So he describes a horse from the back down, and what you can see when a hippopotamus is in the water from that up. So he describes the visible parts of a hippopotamus in the water accurately. So there's a rationalization you can make it work. But not that you want to make apologies for his writing, but there is certainly a school that likes Herodotus. I think Herodotus is a more charming writer than Thucydides is. There's you know, Herodotus is a mine of information that archaeology keeps corroborating, which is always good vindication, not that it's a competition.
Yeah, we can sort of circle back to the issue using Herodotus, because we had the Hittites, of course, which we've talked about extensively, and with the catastrophe in around 1200 BC with the whole of the Mycenaean Hittite, etc., all those kingdoms collapsing, crumbling, or entering into a period of some instability, like in Egypt with the Third Intermediate Period, etc. All of that makes way to the early Iron Age, and in Anatolia you get the rise of the so-called Neo-Hittite kingdoms, and of course also the development of local different types of local peoples, including of course the Carians. To go back to Herodotus, Herodotus came from Halicarnassus, which was a Greek city in Caria itself. And one of the things that is touched in the issue is the problem of so-called Carian armorers. I'm sort of paraphrasing the title of an article by Anthony Snodgrass, because Herodotus claims that characteristic elements of the hoplite panoply, so the typically Greek warrior panoply, let's say, like shield blazons and the method of fastening crests to helmets, etc., that those were elements that were invented not by the Greeks, but adopted by the Greeks from the Carians. And this is something that a lot of military historians focusing on Greece are very quick to dismiss, because they feel like only the Greeks could invent this sort of stuff for their own style of warfare. And so when Herodotus writes this, they say, well, obviously, you know, this is not true, because there is no archaeological evidence to corroborate it. And Herodotus came from Caria, basically, so maybe he's just trying to sort of, you know, increase his own standing or the importance of the country where he came from or whatever. Which is interesting, but it's not completely, doesn't necessarily have to be completely fabricated, but it's one instance where it's very difficult to say, okay, we cannot trust Herodotus, but we don't really have another thing to compare it with. I mean, for example, there is another archaic poem fragment that refers to Carian helmet plumes. So there seems to be some sort of connection, at least in Caria, with helmet plumes in the perception of the ancient Greeks of the 6th and 5th centuries BC. But once again, this is a bit of a problem with sources and source material. But I know that Sean wanted to say something about this topic also, so I will shut up.
One thing we do know, because we have documents from Egypt, from Mesopotamia, is that certainly Carian soldiers are all over from 6th century onwards. Sure, doesn't seem to be any reason to doubt with the vision we get in Herondas that by the 6th century or so, Carian soldiers are fighting in pretty much the same way as soldiers from the other side of the Aegean.
It dates back even to the 7th century, of course, with the men of Herondas Herodotus talks about,
right,
where
Ionians
and Carians operate side by side.
We've got an earlier issue on that, of course. This also came up a bit in that Men of Bronze volume. Kurt Rathbub has a chapter in Men of Bronze looking at possible Near Eastern precedents for Greek warfare. He had a pretty negative view, but on the other hand, there hasn't been maybe as much work as there could be actually making sure that Greek warfare really is so different from what everybody else was doing. If we look through the big names of the classic Greek historiography, pretty much all of them are willing to talk about barbarians who were hoplites or citizen soldiers or formed a phalanx or armed like Greeks, whatever that means exactly, at some point. The Greek sources themselves, the idea that the way Greeks fight and the way other peoples fight is completely different and unrelated is maybe something they are willing to be a little bit flexible on when you help them down to it.
The Greeks were not so very dogmatic as some modern historians are when it comes to Greek modes of warfare.
The other thing, of course, is that the Greek warfare is so unsuited to Greece, as, you know, same with chariots. I mean, if you were going to develop a mode of transport or even a mode of warfare, chariot and hoplite warfare are not what you would do as a Greek. You would choose some form of mountain guerrilla warfare because of the terrain.
It sort of depends on how you interpret what Greek warfare was precisely, which is.
But in terms of getting back to your idea about the origins of those elements and those tactics, they are, you know, flat plane mechanisms which make sense coming from Anatolia, and so the adoption of them by the Greeks, absolutely, but it could be other things in terms of status and things like that. But that whole problem of why they developed and how they developed is still open, rather than, as you say, it doesn't necessarily need to be dogmatic.
That's one of the questions that we got sent in via the miracle of the internet, via Twitter, was how did chariots develop?
The Hurrians are usually considered to have been the first to have the chariot, the two-wheel chariot. Around 1700 BC, and the earliest chariot type things are the battle cars with four wheels that the Sumerians used in the 3rd millennium BC, which is sort of a precursor. But Steve?
The first thing when you're talking about chariots, actually, I don't think the Hurrians developed it. I think the Hurrians probably learned it from Indo-Europeans when the Hurrians were still up around the Caucasus, before they came into the Near East. But that's, I believe me, there's so much dispute on this that it's almost, talking about it is very difficult. What you have to remember about chariots is they were tactical level weapons. They were not operational level weapons. They were not used as an extension of operational art where you're trying to be mobile over long distances like modern armies. Their context was being used in a specific area that was amenable to their use. Armies were infantry armies, and then they found a good open space for the chariots to operate on a tactical level. That being the case, I think it makes perfect sense to use chariots, say, in the Greek peninsula and other areas, because they wouldn't fight with chariots in the mountains. They would find a plain where they could deploy their chariots in their phalanx. I think chariots were developed. More and more, the discoveries of horse-drawn, spoke-wheeled war chariots in South Central Asia is pushing the date of their invention back to before 2000 BC, at least right around 2000 BC. So I think it's becoming almost indisputable that they were developed up north. and that they came down, and that the Sumerian battle cards are something entirely different and were not probably very effective. I don't see how they could be very maneuverable with the four wheels, the big block wheels, and the use of asses to draw them. Once the chariotry was developed, and it was a process of development, I think what you had going was a tactical level weapon that was used in squadrons in the space between armies in the battle space. It was difficult to commit a full chariotry force all at once because of that, because of the rules of parallel battle. Most battles were fought as set piece battles in parallel. What you had at the Battle of Kadesh was two different styles of chariot combat confronting each other. Neither one was superior, but I believe that the Hittite model is eventually what won out, the three-man chariot, and then you go advance to four-man chariots, and then finally as many as five men. In India, they were putting six men and more in chariots. And somebody talked about what caused the demise of chariotry. I think gigantism caused the demise of it. After a certain point, you can only put so many men in a horse-drawn vehicle, and it becomes impossible to be effective on the battlefield. And that, with the rise of heavy infantry and the use of iron, you can make armor instead of going through the laborious process of making bronze. So you can have these effective infantry armies that pretty much dominated the battlefields all the way through the Roman period.
Do you think that the chariots would have actually been used that much against one another? I mean, since they've got so many different styles of, like, the three-man chariot of the Hittites, which seems to be either a lance or something that's being used there as the main major weapon, the Egyptians using the bows, as a platform mobile across the battlefield, or there's the suggestion that the Mycenaeans are using it just as a mobile troop carrier. Are they actually using chariots if it was as chariots at all? Or?
Well, the first thing to say is the Hittites' chariot captain was a bowman. The word for chariot captain is bowman. They have a separate word for when they added the spearman. The spearman was the third man was added between the time of Seti I and the Battle of Kadesh. And it came as a surprise to the Egyptians at the Battle of Kadesh. I think it was an important innovation. It was made possible, I believe, and I've argued, by the bigger, more robust chariots that the Hittites used, with the axle in the center rather than at the rear, which allowed for more ability to carry more weight. I think that those spearmen in the Hittite chariots served as, in a manner of panzer grenadiers or armored infantry, where the chariots would ride into battle and the spearmen would alight, dismount, and they would either serve as defensemen for their own chariots or swarm to attack the Egyptian chariots. The Egyptians also had a third man, but he was a runner, and that was a disadvantage for the Egyptians because they could never go too far or too fast on the battlefield with their man-at-arms running alongside their chariots, risk exhaustion of that man-at-arms. That is one reason why I think that the brilliantly conceived tactic at the Battle of Kadesh by the Hittites was to put these three men in the chariots, and they could do a wide flanking maneuver with over 2,000 chariots. Think of that, emerging from the forest as they did. Imagine being in the marching Egyptian column and seeing 2,000 chariots coming at you. At a certain point, those chariots would have stopped. The third men with the pikes would have alighted. They would have gone out with those spears and started poking the horses with them, probably putting the spears into the spokes of the Egyptian chariot wheels. It would have been quite devastating. Meanwhile, the Hittite chariot captains would be providing covering fire with their bows. The question is why didn't they win the battle? Well, actually, they did win it strategically, but they had a bit of bad luck. The Narn column came in the nick of time and saved Pharaoh's bacon. What we see after that is almost all chariot forces in the ancient Near East adopting the three-man model. The Egyptians obviously kept the two-man model through the Sea People's battles, and then I don't know what happened with them. They probably adopted a three-man model too. But it's significant that the Sea People's chariots also had three men.
How did you see this working? So the chariots would ride in, your spearmen would alight, then what would they form up as some sort of phalanx with the chariot behind, at which point they're almost like lightning infantry?
What I think happened in the tradition, the paradigm of parallel battle is the armies would draw up opposite each other, just out of bow shot. This would form a battle space, which you can almost measure about, 300 to 400 yards, whatever. Into that battle space would ride the chariots. They would come in squadrons, and they would fight each other. And their third men, runners or mounted men dismounting, what have you, would also be fighting with each other. And in fact, in the Kadesh illustrations, we have a picture of Shardana swordsmen who are great chariot killers pulling a Hittite charioteer off of his chariot and slitting his throat. So we have an instance of swarming infantry there. And it's significant at Kadesh, I believe, that when the pharaoh launches his counterattacks, they make mention of his Shardana bodyguard joining him in that action. And I think what we're seeing there is his Shardana infantrymen with their big, round, almost archive-type shields and their long-pointed swords swarming at the Hittite chariots whilst the pharaoh is providing covering fire with his bow. And you have quite an effective combined arms team there, which mimics very closely, or at least presages very closely, tank armored infantry action. You never send tanks in the battle without infantry support. And in the same sense, the ancient chariot forces would never send chariots into battle without infantry support. But I think at a certain point, when the chariot clash is over and one of the chariot forces is driven off, then the decision is decided by the infantry bodies advancing into each other. And again, the Kadesh illustrations are revealing in that regard, because what you see there very clearly are the Hittite and Egyptian chariotry brigades battling each other in the battle space, and on either side of them you see phalanxed Egyptian infantry. I think that chariotry was the core, but the arm of decision was the infantry.
This was also sort of the criticism that people leveled at Druze's book, about which I've talked before.
I disagree with Druze too.
Yeah, everybody disagrees with Druze, I think. Druze, for listeners who don't know, Druze wrote a book about the catastrophe 1200 BC, the end of the Bronze Age, is the title, if I recall correctly, in which he proposed that the kingdoms of the Bronze Age basically lost because they were swarmed by barbarians from the north who used infantry, and that their chariot-centered armies couldn't cope, which is basically nonsense, because all armies throughout history basically have been infantry-based exceptions.
I think what you do see is infantry more and more being used in conjunction with chariotry, but it certainly did end chariotry. It continued into the Iron Age. Chariotry was a major combat arm for quite a while.
Yeah, the Assyrians, for example, they built these really heavy chariots at one point also, well into the, 8th century, I think.
The depictions of Egyptian chariots with their two men and their runner are of the king generally firing from a moving chariot. Are you saying that the standard was, for instance, for the Hittite chariots to stop their men to dismount and form up, and therefore they were a stationary archery platform?
No, I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear. I think at some point the third man would have leapt out. One of my other arguments is the battle speed of chariots. There was no galloping with the chariots, and I think they drove in collection. I don't know if I need to explain collection. Please tell me. The whole idea was they would come, a great chariot force crossing the battlefield would be coming at a very stately pace with the horses trotting like Tennessee trotters or something like that. That enhances the stability of the platform.
I also like the fact that for the Homeric picture of warfare, the chariot keeps the infantryman who dismounts but loses the archer, which is a sort of an interesting development linearly of the chariot warfare rather than, and whether that's a Homeric in terms of the Trojan War or 8th century kind of development, it's interesting.
It's probably the same. If you look at the evidence, painted vases and frescoes from the 13th and 12th century BC and the 8th century BC, they're basically the same. So there's probably continuity there in just having a guy with a spear on a chariot riding around on the battlefield and then dismounting when he's near the enemy and then fighting in the Homeric manner. At least that's my argument in my book.
I concur.
Don't we have a reasonable amount of evidence for bows and arrows in the Mycenaean context? We have sea lord ever that shows a lion hunt. So clearly they were practicing archery. Chariot.
No, that definitely. But there's just the big frescoes where we have where we actually see warriors, the guys with spears, and there's also the grave theli, of course, of a guy running another guy down with a lance from a chariot, which is not unique, but it is remarkable. Those scenes, those let's say Near Eastern style scenes of men hunting with bows and arrows on chariots. It's
for that picture that's often read as a chariot lancer running down a man on foot. I'm with Dan Howard on that one. That probably the long straight thing is supposed to be the reins of the chariot, and he's clearly chasing. Maybe he is chasing down that guy on foot, but. I don't think he's supposed to be chasing down with a lance pouched under his arm like some kind of late medieval knight or something. Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing from the Mycenaean period that we have that shows something like that. So yeah, if it's again, it's the Herodotus problem. Let's say if you have one source, it's a bit difficult.
How did they pay for all the? The chariots must have been a standing force. If you have 2,000 chariots in the field, that's 4,000 horses. That's even more that you've got to have stabled, trained. Presumably, these are all specialized.
Yes.
You're not just getting any old levies and telling them to stand there with his spear. And
according to Beale, the Hittite king at Muwatalli had 3,500 chariots at the Battle of Kadesh. He committed his tactical reserve, midway through the battle. He points out that there wasn't 2,000 of those were a permanent standing chariot force. There were elite chariots called elite chariot fighters called the golden chariot fighters, but the state supported the bulk of the force, and then allies also had their own chariot forces. I don't know about the other countries, but the Hittites had a very complex state-supported horse breeding, raising, procuring system, and they did have a standing army that was augmented in times of war by levies and allies.
In case of the Mycenaeans, the Linear B tablets suggest that there's a mix of public and private means. So, for example, you have the Hecatae, who are the chariot warriors, and there are Linear B tablets that say that the palace provided one wheel and one horse to Hecata so-and-so. And the idea is that the Hecatae probably maintained their own chariots, but if they needed something specific, the palace could sort of make a donation in exchange for their military support. So it's sort of a mix of private public funds.
The records at Pylos, Do they indicate that those chariots were owned by the state and stored in warehouses in a dismantled condition?
No, as far as I know, there are no tablets that say anything about where they are being kept, which is those tablets are, on one hand, they have a lot of details, but they're always infuriatingly incomplete, of course. We just have that Palace sending out bits and pieces of equipment to certain men. And the idea is that this was a mixture of public and private means, and probably also part of the soldiery, that the palace sort of ruled top-down with the king and his bureaucracy, sort of appointing Hecatae as commanders of particular posts, and then Hecatae had to pick their own sub-commanders and their own, levy own troops and that sort of stuff. So you would have this sort of top-down arrangement where people sort of delegated obligations and downwards in a particular manner. But they could always fall back on the palace if they were higher up, let's say, if they needed something specific that they didn't have or that they wanted in exchange for military service or whatever. That was sort of the idea.
What happened to the Hittite Empire?
I would say they were destroyed quite suddenly during the reign of Shubaluliuma II by Kashka barbarians invading from the north. They sacked Hattusha. And sea peoples coming in through the south along the coast. We do have letters being written by Shubaluliuma to Egypt asking for grain to be sent, that there was a state of emergency in the kingdom, and then all of a sudden, nothing.
When you say all of a sudden, how much is all of a sudden?
I think that the sack of Hattusha probably happened quite quickly, overnight. I think that Kaska probably saw what was happening with the sea people swarming in through the south, and they made an opportunistic invasion, and they sacked Hattusha. It wasn't the first time that Hattusha had been sacked. I think that probably happened quite quickly. And again, right before that happened, Shubaluliuma II was writing letters to Egypt, and he also mentions a big sea battle being fought around Cyprus, and the Hittite navy was basically farmed out to the Lucan people. And apparently they lost a big sea battle off the coast. So something was going on and something was happening quite quickly. But, you know, how long it took for the sea peoples to destroy those kingdoms, I don't know.
I did notice the article by Constantine Nosor. He thinks that according to the latest archaeological results, Hattusha was abandoned first, and then at some point, not too long after.
I mean, that sounds plausible, too. The idea that, remember, with Ugarit, all of a sudden, they're burned. It's destroyed. And that's just south of the Hittite realm. So things were unfolding quite quickly, I think.
Yeah, it's basically the same picture as elsewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean, where you get a sense of the sources that there is this relatively sudden upsurge of trouble, of people on the move and of them not really knowing how to cope, and then you have these half panicky documents, and then it sort of ends all of a sudden.
So yeah, and even up.
Does seem to be sort of relatively swift, whatever it was that destroyed. I mean, the destructions are all human attributable, of course, but there was loads of stuff happening. Eric Klein's book that we already mentioned in a previous podcast, 1187 BC, gives a pretty good up-to-date overview of scholarship in this field, I think. So
to get a sense of the drama of the period, you have those messages being recorded at Pulos about, you know, watchtowers, lighting fires, people coming down from the north, and then this kind of rolling tsunami that seems to, you know, just move inexorably across the landscape and the oceans. And, you know, and then you have that great, wonderfully written Egyptian text where he talks about the peoples of the sea made a conspiracy in their islands. They came before us. The flame was lit in Amor. Nothing couldn't withstand us. We have laid our plans. I mean, that's pretty dramatic stuff.
And at the same time, of course, where one thing ends, another thing continues. I mean, in the case of the Hittite Empire, when it collapses, when it disappears, you have the emergence of these new Neo-Hittite kingdoms, mostly city-states, basically, that emerge afterwards. So from the ashes rise different phoenixes, and that's the same throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, of course. So it's not a definitive end, let's say, just an end of this particular socio-political system that was in existence in the Late Bronze Age.
I think we should leave things there. I'd like to thank Joshua, Murray, Mark, Sean and Stephen. In the next episode of the podcast, we'll be looking at the First Punic War. If you've not read the magazine and would like to swat up, don't forget you can go to ancient-warfare.com to purchase your copy of the magazine. I'm Angus Wallace. And thanks for listening.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.